but it's too dangerous. He knows it. We push each other away, not far. Too much trust, too much risk, too much already. I was coming to find you, he says, breathes almost into my ear. I want to reach up, taste his skin. He makes me hungry. His fingers move, feeling my arm under the nightgown sleeve, as if his hand won't listen to reason. It's so good to be touched by someone, to be felt so greedily, to feel so greedy. Luke, you'd know, you'd understand. It's you here, in another body. Bullshit. Why, I say, is it so bad for him that he'd take the risk of coming to my room at night? I think of the hanged men, hooked on the wall. I can hardly stand up. I have to get away, back to the stairs, before I dissolve entirely. His hands on my shoulder now, held still, heavy, pressing down on me like warm lead. Is this what I would die for? I'm a coward. I hate the thought of pain. He told me to, Nick says. He wants to see you in his office. What do you mean, I say? The commander, it must be. See me? What does he mean by see? Hasn't he had enough of me? Tomorrow, he says, just audible. In the dark parlor, we move away from each other slowly, as if pulled toward each other by a force, current, pulled apart also by hands equally strong. I find the door, turn the knob, fingers on cool porcelain, open. It's all I can do. Night, 18. I lie in bed, still trembling. You can wet the rim of a glass and run your finger around the rim and it will make a sound. This is what I feel like, this sound of glass. I feel like the word shatter. I want to be with someone. Lying in bed with Luke, his hand on my rounded belly, the three of us in bed, she kicking, turning over within me. Thunderstorm outside the window, that's why she's awake. They can hear, they sleep, they can be startled. Even there in the soothing of the heart, like waves on the shore around them. A flash of lightning, quite close. Luke's eyes go white for an instant. I'm not frightened. We're wide awake. The rain hits now. We will be slow and careful. If I thought this would never happen again, I would die. But this is wrong. Nobody dies from lack of sex. It's lack of love we die from. There's nobody here I can love. All the people I could love are dead or elsewhere. Who knows where they are or what their names are now? They might as well be nowhere as I am for them. I, too, am a missing person. From time to time I can see their faces against the dark, flickering like the images of saints in old foreign cathedrals, in the light of the drafty candles, candles you would light to pray by, kneeling, your forehead against the wooden railing, hoping for an answer. I can conjure them, but they are mirages only. They don't last. Can I be blamed for wanting a real body to put my arms around? Without it, I too am disembodied. I can listen to my own heartbeat against the bed springs. I can stroke myself under the dry white sheets in the dark. But I too am dry and white, hard, granular. It's like running my hand over a plateful of dried rice. It's like snow. There's something dead about it, something deserted. I'm like a room where things once happened and now nothing does, except the pollen of the weeds that grow up outside the window, blowing in as dust across the floor. Here is what I believe. I believe Luke is lying face down in a thicket, a tangle of bracken, the brown fronds from last year under the green ones just unrolled, or ground hemlock, perhaps, although it's too early for the red berries. What is left of him, his hair, the bones, the plaid wool shirt, green and black, the leather belt, the work boots. I know exactly what he was wearing. I can see his clothes in my mind, bright as a lithograph, or a full-color advertisement from an ancient magazine, though not his face, not so well. His face is beginning to fade, possibly because it wasn't always the same. His face had different expressions, his clothes did not. I pray that the hole, or two or three, there was more than one shot, they were close together. I pray that at least one hole is neatly, quickly, and finally through the skull, through the place where all the pictures were, so that there would have been only the one flash of darkness or pain. Dull, I hope, like the word thud. Only the one, and then silence. I believe this. I also believe that Luke is sitting up in a rectangle somewhere, gray cement on a ledge, or the edge of something, a bed or chair. God knows what he's wearing. God knows what they've put him in. God isn't the only one who knows, so maybe there could be some way of finding out. He hasn't shaved for a year, though they cut his hair short, whenever they feel like it, for lice, they say. I'll have to revise that. If they cut the hair for lice, they'd cut the beard too. You'd think. Anyway, they don't do it well. The hair is ragged. The back of his neck is nicked. That's hardly the worst. He looks 10 years older, 20. He's bent like an old man. His eyes are pouched. Small purple veins have burst in his cheeks. There's a scar. No, a wound. It isn't yet healed, the color of tulips near the stem end, down the left side of his face where the flesh split recently. The body is so easily damaged, so easily disposed of. Water and chemicals is all it is, hardly more to it than a jellyfish drying on sand. He finds it painful to move his hands, painful to move. He doesn't know what he's accused of. A problem. There must be something, some accusation. Otherwise, why are they keeping him? Why isn't he already dead? He must know something they want to know. I can't imagine. I can't imagine he hasn't already said whatever it is. I would. He is surrounded by a smell, his own, the smell of a cooped-up animal in a dirty cage. I imagine him resting, because I can't bear to imagine him at any other time, just as I can't imagine anything below his collar, above his cuffs. I don't want to think what they've done to his body. Does he have shoes? No, and the floor is cold and wet. Does he know I'm here, alive, that I'm thinking about him? I have to believe so. In reduced circumstances, you have to believe all kinds of things. I believe in thought transference now, vibrations in the ether, that sort of junk. I never used to. I also believe that they didn't catch him, or catch up with him after all, that he made it, reached the bank, swam the river, crossed the border, dragged himself up on the far shore, an island, teeth chattering, found his way to a nearby farmhouse, was allowed in, with suspicion at first, but then when they understood who he was, they were friendly, not the sort who would turn him in. Perhaps they were Quakers. They will smuggle him inland, from house to house. The woman made him some hot coffee and gave him a set of her husband's clothes. I picture the clothes. It comforts me to dress him warmly. He has made contact with the others. There must be a resistance, a government in exile. Someone must be out there taking care of things. I believe in the resistance, as I believe there can be no light without shadow, or rather, no shadow unless there is also light. There must be a resistance. Or where do all the criminals come from? On the television. Any day now, there may be a message from him. It will come in the most unexpected way from the least likely person, someone I never would have suspected. Under my plate, on the dinner tray, slipped into my hand as I reached the tokens across the counter in all flesh. The message will say that I must have patience. Sooner or later he will get me out. We will find her, wherever they've put her. She'll remember us, and we will be all three of us together. Meanwhile, I must endure, keep myself safe for later. What has happened to me, what's happening to me now, won't make any difference to him. He loves me anyway. He knows it isn't my fault. The message will say that also. It's this message, which may never arrive, that keeps me alive. I believe in the message. The things I believe can't all be true, though one of them must be, but I believe in all of them, all three versions of Luke at one and the same time. This contradictory way of believing seems to me, right now, the only way I can believe anything. Whatever the truth is, I will be ready for it. This also is a belief of mine. This also may be untrue. One of the gravestones in the cemetery near the earliest church has an anchor on it and an hourglass, and the words, "In hope." In hope. Why did they put that above a dead person? Was it the corpse hoping, or those still alive? Does Luke hope? Birthday. 19. I'm dreaming that I am awake. I dream that I get out of the bed and walk across the room, not this room, and go out the door, not this door. I'm at home, one of my homes, and she's running to meet me in her small green nightgown with the sunflower on the front, her feet bare, and I pick her up and feel her arms and legs go around me, and I begin to cry because I know then that I'm not awake. I'm back in this bed, trying to wake up, and I wake up and sit on the edge of the bed, and my mother comes in with a tray and asks me if I'm feeling better. When I was sick as a child, she had to stay home from work. But I'm not awake this time either. After these dreams, I do awake, and I know I'm really awake, because there is the wreath on the ceiling and my curtains hanging like drowned white hair. I feel drugged. I consider this. Maybe they're drugging me. Maybe the life I think I'm living is a paranoid delusion. Not a hope. I know where I am and who and what day it is. These are the tests, and I am sane. Sanity is a valuable possession. I hoard it the way people once hoarded money. I save it so I will have enough when the time comes. Grayness comes through the curtains, hazy bright. Not much sun today. I get out of bed, go to the window, kneel on the window seat, the hard little cushion, faith, and look out. There is nothing to be seen. I wonder what has become of the other two cushions. There must have been three once, hope and charity. Where have they been stowed? Serena Joy has tidy habits. She wouldn't throw away anything not quite worn out. One for Rita, one for Cora. The bell goes. I'm up before it ahead of time. I dress, not looking down. I sit in the chair and think about the word chair. It can also mean the leader of a meeting. It can also mean a mode of execution. It is the first syllable in charity. It is the French word for flesh. None of these facts has any connection with the others. These are the kinds of litanies I use to compose myself. In front of me is a tray, and on the tray are a glass of apple juice, a vitamin pill, a spoon, a plate with three slices of brown toast on it, a small dish containing honey, and another plate with an egg cup on it, the kind that looks like a woman's torso in a skirt. Under the skirt is the second egg being kept warm. The egg cup is white china with a blue stripe. The first egg is white. I move the egg cup a little, so now it's in the watery sunlight that comes through the window and falls, brightening, waning, brightening again on the tray. The shell of the egg is smooth but also grained. Small pebbles of calcium are defined by the sunlight like craters on the moon. It's a barren landscape, yet perfect. It's the sort of desert the saints went into, so their minds would not be distracted by profusion. I think that this is what God must look like, an egg. The life of the moon may not be on the surface, but inside. The egg is glowing now, as if it had an energy of its own. To look at the egg gives me intense pleasure. The sun goes, and the egg fades. I pick the egg out of the cup and finger it for a moment. It's warm. Women used to carry such eggs between their breasts to incubate them. That would have felt good. The minimalist life. Pleasure is an egg. Blessings that can be counted on the fingers of one hand. But possibly this is how I am expected to react. If I have an egg, what more can I want? In reduced circumstances, the desire to live attaches itself to strange objects. I would like a pet, a bird, say, or a cat, a familiar, anything at all familiar. A rat would do in a pinch, but there's no chance of that. This house is too clean. I slice the top off the egg with the spoon and eat the contents. While I'm eating the second egg, I hear the siren. At a great distance at first, winding its way toward me among the large houses and clipped lawns, a thin sound like the hum of an insect, then nearing, opening out, like a flower of sound opening into a trumpet. A proclamation, this siren. I put down my spoon. My heart speeds up. I go to the window again. Will it be blue and not for me? But I see it turn the corner. Come along the street, stop in front of the house, still blaring, and it's red. Joy to the world, rare enough these days. I leave the second egg, half eaten, hurry to the closet for my cloak, and already I can hear feet on the stairs and the voices calling. Hurry, says Cora, won't wait all day. And she helps me on with the cloak. She's actually smiling. I almost run down the hall. The stairs are like skiing. The front door is wide. Today I can go through it, and the guardian stands there saluting. It started to rain, a drizzle, and a gravid smell of earth and grass fills the air. The red birthmobile is parked in the driveway. Its back door is open, and I clamber in. The carpet on the floor is red. Red curtains are drawn over the windows. There are three women in here already, sitting on the benches that run the length of the van on either side. The guardian closes and locks the double doors and climbs into the front beside the driver. Through the glassed-over wire grille, we can see the backs of their heads. We start with a lurch. While overhead the siren screams, "Make way! Make way!" "Who is it?" I say to the woman next to me, into her ear, or where her ear must be under the white headdress. I almost have to shout, the noise is so loud. "Of Warren!" she shouts back. Impulsively she grabs my hand, squeezes it. As we lurch around the corner, she turns to me and I see her face. There are tears running down her cheeks. But tears of what? Envy? Disappointment? But no, she's laughing. She throws her arms around me. I've never seen her before. She hugs me. She has large breasts under the red habit. She wipes her sleeve across her face. On this day, we can do anything we want. I revise that. Within limits. Across from us, on the other bench, one woman is praying, eyes closed, hands up to her mouth. Or she may not be praying. She may be biting her thumbnails. Possibly she's trying to keep calm. The third woman is calm already. She sits with her arms folded, smiling a little. The siren goes on and on. That used to be the sound of death for ambulances or fires. Possibly it will be the sound of death today also. We will soon know. What will Av Warren give birth to? A baby, as we all hope? Or something else? An unbaby, with a pinhead, or a snout like a dog's, or two bodies, or a hole in its heart, or no arms, or webbed hands and feet. There's no telling. They could tell once, with machines, but that is now outlawed. What would be the point of knowing anyway? You can't have them taken out. Whatever it is must be carried to term. The chances are 1 in 4. We learned that at the center. The air got too full once of chemicals, rays, radiation. The water swarmed with toxic molecules. All that takes years to clean up, and meanwhile they creep into your body, camp out in your fatty cells. Who knows? Your very flesh may be polluted, dirty as an oily beach. Sure death to shorebirds and unborn babies. Maybe a vulture would die of eating you. Maybe you light up in the dark like an old-fashioned watch. Death watch. That's a kind of beetle that buries carrion. I can't think of myself, my body sometimes, without seeing the skeleton. How I must appear to an electron. A cradle of life made of bones. And within, hazards, warped proteins, bad crystals jagged as glass. Women took medicines, pills. Men sprayed trees. Cows ate grass. All that souped-up piss flowed into the rivers, not to mention the exploding atomic power plants along the San Andreas Fault, nobody's fault, during the earthquakes, and the mutant strain of syphilis no mold could touch. Some did it themselves, had themselves tied shut with catgut or scarred with chemicals. How could they, said Aunt Lydia. Oh, how could they have done such a thing, Jezebels, scorning God's gifts, wringing her hands. It's a risk you're taking, said Aunt Lydia, but you are the shock troops. You will march out in advance into dangerous territory. The greater the risk, the greater the glory. She clasped her hands, radiant with our phony courage. We looked down at the tops of our desks. To go through all that and give birth to a shredder, it wasn't a fine thought. We didn't know exactly what would happen to the babies that didn't get passed, that were declared un-babies. But we knew they were put somewhere, quickly, away. There was no one cause, says Aunt Lydia. She stands in the front of the room in her khaki dress, a pointer in her hand. Pulled down in front of the blackboard, where once there would have been a map, is a graph showing the birth rate per thousand for years and years. A slippery slope down past the zero line of replacement, and down, and down. Of course, some women believed there would be no future. They thought the world would explode. That was the excuse they used, says Aunt Lydia. They said there was no sense in breeding. Aunt Lydia's nostrils narrow. Such wickedness. They were lazy women, she says. They were sluts. On the top of my desk there are initials, carved into the wood, and dates. The initials are sometimes in two sets joined by the word loves. J.H. Loves. B.P., 1954. O.R. loves L.T. These seem to me like the inscriptions I used to read about, carved on the stone walls of caves, or drawn with a mixture of soot and animal fat. They seem to me incredibly ancient. The desktop is of blonde wood. It slants down, and there is an armrest on the right side to lean on when you were writing on paper with a pen. Inside the desk you could keep things, books, notebooks. These habits of former times appear to me now lavish, decadent almost, immoral, like the orgies of barbarian regimes. M. loves G. 1972. This carving, done with a pencil dug many times into the worn varnish of the desk, has the pathos of all vanished civilizations. It's like a handprint on stone. Whoever made that was once alive. There are no dates after the mid-80s. This must have been one of the schools that was closed down then for lack of children. They made mistakes, said Aunt Lydia. We don't intend to repeat them. Her voice is pious, condescending, the voice of those whose duty it is to tell us unpleasant things for our own good. I would like to strangle her. I shove this thought away almost as soon as I think it. A thing is valued, she says, only if it is rare and hard to get. We want you to be valued, girls. She is rich in pauses, which she savors in her mouth. Think of yourselves as pearls. We, sitting in our rows, eyes down, we make her salivate morally. We are hers to define. We must suffer her adjectives. I think about pearls. Pearls are congealed oyster spit. This is what I will tell Maura later, if I can. All of us here will lick you into shape, says Aunt Lydia with satisfied good cheer. The van stops. The back doors are opened. The guardian herds us out. At the front door stands another guardian. With one of those snubby machine guns slung over his shoulder, we file toward the front door in the drizzle, the guardian saluting. The big emerge van, the one with the machines and the mobile doctors, is parked further along the circular drive. I see one of the doctors looking out of the window of the van. I wonder what they do in there waiting. Play cards, most likely, or read. Some masculine pursuit. Most of the time they aren't needed at all. They're only allowed in if it can't be helped. It used to be different. They used to be in charge. A shame it was, said Aunt Lydia. Shameful! What she just showed us was a film made in the olden days hospital. A pregnant woman, wired up to a machine, electrodes coming out of her every which way, so that she looked like a broken robot. An intravenous drip feeding into her arm. Some man with a searchlight looking up between her legs where she's been shaved, a mere beardless girl, a tray full of bright sterilized knives, everyone with masks on. A cooperative patient. Once they drugged women, induced labor, cut them open, sewed them up. No more. No anesthetics, even. Aunt Elizabeth said it was better for the baby, but also, I will greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception. In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children. At lunch we got that, brown bread and lettuce sandwiches. As I'm going up the steps, wide steps with a stone urn on either side, of Warren's commander must be higher status than ours, I hear another siren. It's the blue birthmobile for wives. That will be Serena Joy arriving in state. No benches for them. They get real seats, upholstery. They face front and are not curtained off. They know where they're going. Probably Serena Joy has been here before to this house for tea. Probably Av Warren, formerly that whiny bitch Janine, was paraded out in front of her and the other wives, so they could see her belly, feel it perhaps, and congratulate the wife. A strong girl, good muscles. No Agent Orange in her family. We checked the records. You can never be too careful. And perhaps one of the kinder ones. Would you like a cookie, dear? Oh, no, you'll spoil her. Too much sugar is bad for them. Surely one won't hurt just this once, Mildred. And sucky Janine. Oh, yes, can I, ma'am, please? Such a... so well behaved, not surly like some of them, do their job and that's that, more like a daughter to you, as you might say, one of the family. Comfortable matronly chuckles. That's all, dear. You can go back to your room. And after she's gone. Little whores, all of them. But still, you can't be choosy. You take what they hand out, right, girls? That from the commander's wife. Mine. Oh, but you've been so lucky. Some of them, why, they aren't even clean and won't give you a smile. Mope in their rooms, don't wash their hair. The smell. I have to get the Marthas to do it. Almost have to hold her down in the bathtub. You practically have to bribe her to get her to take a bath, even. You have to threaten her. I had to take stern measures with mine, and now she doesn't eat her dinner properly. And as for the other thing, not a nibble, and we've been so regular. But yours, she's a credit to you. And any day now, oh, you must be so excited, she's big as a house. I bet you can hardly wait. More tea? Modestly changing the subject. I know the sort of thing that goes on. And Janine, up in her room, what does she do? Sits with the taste of sugar still in her mouth, licking her lips, stares out of the window, breathes in and out, caresses her swollen breasts, thinks of nothing. 20. The central staircase is wider than ours, with a curved banister on either side. From above, I can hear the chanting of the women who are already there. We go up the stairs, single file, being careful not to step on the trailing hems of each other's dresses. To the left, the double doors to the dining room are folded back, and inside I can see the long table covered with a white cloth and spread with a buffet. Ham, cheese, oranges. They have oranges, and fresh-baked breads and cakes. As for us, we'll get milk and sandwiches on a tray later. But they have a coffee urn and bottles of wine, for why shouldn't the wives get a little drunk on such a triumphant day? First they'll wait for the results, then they'll pig out. They're gathered in the sitting room on the other side of the stairway now, cheering on this commander's wife, the wife of Warren. A small, thin woman, she lies on the floor in a white cotton nightgown, her graying hair spreading like mildew over the rug. They massage her tiny belly, just as if she's really about to give birth herself. The commander, of course, is nowhere in sight. He's gone wherever men go on such occasions, some hideout. Probably he's figuring out when his promotion is likely to be announced if all goes well. He's sure to get one now. Off Warren is in the master bedroom, a good name for it, where this commander and his wife nightly bed down. She's sitting on their king-sized bed, propped with pillows. Janine, inflated but reduced, shorn of her former name. She's wearing a white cotton shift, which is hiked up over her thighs. Her long, broom-colored hair is pulled back and tied behind her head to keep it out of the way. Her eyes are squeezed closed, and this way I can almost like her. After all, she's one of us. What did she ever want but to lead her life as agreeably as possible? What else did any of us want? It's the possible that's the catch. She's not doing badly under the circumstances. Two women I don't know stand on either side of her, gripping her hands, or she theirs. A third lifts the nightgown, pours baby oil onto her mound of stomach, rubs downward. At her feet stands Aunt Elizabeth in her khaki dress with the military breast pockets. She was the one who taught gynae. All I can see of her is the side of her head, her profile, but I know it's her, that jutting nose and handsome chin, severe. At her side stands the birthing stool, with its double seat, the back one raised like a throne behind the other. They won't put Janine on it before it's time. The blankets stand ready, the small tub for bathing, the bowl of ice for Janine to suck. The rest of the women sit cross-legged on the rug. There's a crowd of them. Everyone in this district is supposed to be here. There must be 25, 30. Not every commander has a handmaid. Some of their wives have children. From each, says the slogan, according to her ability, to each according to his needs. We recited that 3 times after dessert. It was from the Bible, or so they said. St. Paul again, in Acts. You are a transitional generation, said Aunt Lydia. It is the hardest for you. We know the sacrifices you are being expected to make. It is hard when men revile you. For the ones who come after you, it will be easier. They will accept their duties with willing hearts. She did not say, because they will have no memories of any other way. She said, because they won't want things they can't have. Once a week, we had movies after lunch and before our nap. We sat on the floor of the domestic science room on our little gray mats and waited while Aunt Helena and Aunt Lydia struggled with the projection equipment. If we were lucky, we wouldn't get the film threaded upside down. What it reminded me of was geography classes at my own high school thousands of years before, where they showed movies of the rest of the world. Women in long skirts or cheap printed cotton dresses, carrying bundles of sticks or baskets or plastic buckets of water from some river or other, with babies slung on them in shawls or net slings, looking squint-eyed or afraid out of the screen at us. Knowing something was being done to them by a machine with one glass eye, but not knowing what. Those movies were comforting and faintly boring. They made me feel sleepy, even when men came onto the screen with naked muscles, hacking away at hard dirt with primitive hoes and shovels, hauling rocks. I preferred movies with dancing in them, singing, ceremonial masks, carved artifacts for making music, feathers, brass buttons, conch shells, drums. I liked watching these people when they were happy, not when they were miserable, starving, emaciated, straining themselves to death over some simple thing, the digging of a well, the irrigation of land, problems the civilized nations had long ago solved. I thought someone should just give them the technology and let them get on with it. Aunt Lydia didn't show these kinds of movies. Sometimes the movie she showed would be an old porno film from the 70s or 80s. Women kneeling, sucking penises or guns, women tied up or chained or with dog collars around their necks, women hanging from trees or upside down, naked with their legs held apart, women being raped, beaten up, killed. Once we had to watch a woman being slowly cut into pieces, her fingers and breasts snipped off with garden shears, her stomach slit open, and her intestines pulled out. "Consider the alternatives," said Aunt Lydia. "You see what things used to be like?" That was what they thought of women then. Her voice trembled with indignation. Mara said later that it wasn't real. It was done with models, but it was hard to tell. Sometimes, though, the movie would be what Aunt Lydia called an unwoman documentary. Imagine, said Aunt Lydia, wasting their time like that when they should have been doing something useful. Back then, the unwomen were always wasting time. They were encouraged to do it. The government gave them money to do that very thing. Mind you, some of their ideas were sound enough, she went on with the smug authority in her voice of one who is in a position to judge. We would have to condone some of their ideas even today. Only some, mind you, she said coyly, raising her index finger, waggling it at us. But they were godless, and that can make all the difference, don't you agree? I sat on my mat, hands folded, and Aunt Lydia steps to the side, away from the screen, and the lights go out. And I wonder whether I can, in the dark, lean far over to the right without being seen and whisper to the woman next to me. What will I whisper? I will say, "Have you seen Mara?" because nobody has. She wasn't at breakfast. But the room, though dim, isn't dark enough, so I switch my mind into the holding pattern that passes for attention. They don't play the soundtrack on movies like these, though they do on the porno films. They want us to hear the screams and grunts and shrieks of what is supposed to be either extreme pain or extreme pleasure or both at once, but they don't want us to hear what the unwomen are saying. First come the title and some names, blacked out on the film with a crayon so we can't read them, and then I see my mother, my young mother, younger than I remember her, as young as she must have been before I was born. She's wearing the kind of outfit Aunt Lydia told us was typical of unwomen in those days. Overall jeans with a green and mauve plaid shirt underneath and sneakers on her feet. The same sort of thing Mara once wore. The sort of thing I can remember wearing long ago myself. Her hair is tucked into a mauve handkerchief tied behind her head. Her face is very young, very serious, even pretty. I've forgotten my mother was once as pretty and as earnest as that. She's in a group of other women dressed in the same fashion. She's holding a stick. No, it's part of a banner, the handle. The camera pans up and we see the writing in paint on what must have been a bedsheet. Take back the night. This hasn't been blacked out, even though we aren't supposed to be reading. The women around me breathe in. There's a stirring in the room like wind over grass. Is this an oversight? Have we gotten away with something? Or is this a thing we're intended to see to remind us of the old days of no safety? Behind this sign, there are other signs, and the camera notices them briefly. Freedom to choose. Every baby a wanted baby. Recapture our bodies. Do you believe a woman's place is on the kitchen table? Under the last sign, there's a line drawing of a woman's body lying on a table, blood dripping out of it. Now my mother is moving forward. She's smiling, laughing. They all move forward, and now they're raising their fists in the air. The camera moves to the sky where hundreds of balloons rise, trailing their strings, red balloons with a circle painted on them. A circle with a stem, like the stem of an apple, the stem of a cross. Back on the earth, my mother is part of the crowd now, and I can't see her anymore.
This ends side two of cassette three. Please stop the tape before fast-forwarding to the end and loading cassette four.